Welcome to episode 13 of the Consider the Dog podcast. Brian Agnew is back in this episode. We start off with a deep dive into Brian's understanding of pack, prey, and defense drives, followed by advice to one of our members who is training a human aggressive bulldog and another member who has a German Shepherd that goes into overdrive whenever she sees a critter out the window. As always, Brian shares practical and wise guidance that is really worth a listen, so let's get started. Just like our relationships with other humans in our lives, our relationships with our dogs are dynamic and complex. I believe that in order for those relationships to flourish, or to find resolution when those relationships become strained, we must attend to them thoughtfully and with care. Welcome to the Consider the Dog podcast, created from archived recordings of live sessions where our members get to ask their most burning questions to some of the greatest practitioners of canine behavior. I'm your host, Tyler Muto. I hope you enjoy this episode. And remember, if you want to join the conversation live, you can visit us at ConsiderTheDog.com.
We are now live and we have Brian back. I'm very excited to have Brian back. I love talking to Brian. And I know you guys are excited too, because we have so many questions that have come in. So we're a little delayed. So I'm going to jump right into it. Let me get to my question sheet from Jake.
There was a couple on in the group I noticed too.
Yeah, a bunch of questions in the group. Let me, my eyes are getting old. I gotta zoom in here on this. Let's see here. Let's go 150%. Ah, now I can read it. Okay. All right. So I'm going to start with some of the questions from Facebook. We're going to just jump right into it. So the first question comes from Jay. And I always love Jay's comments and questions. Jay Hamlin has always got some nice thoughtful comments and work that he shows. So he's asking about pack work. I'm assuming probably socialization type pack work, dogs interacting together. And he asks, when do you intervene? When do you let it play out? You know, how hands-on is hands-on, how hands-off is hands-off. Is punishment or corrections effective in pack work, or is it more of like a pressure release sort of negative reinforcement type deal? I'm going to let you take it away, because I know you do a lot with letting some of your board and trained dogs socialize with your personal dogs and using that to help them get through some of their anxieties and stuff.
Yeah, I think that just, it's all contingent on, I think there was something, it's all contingent. Like right now I have a 7-month-old Weimaraner and a Great Dane. They're relentless, you know, when they play, it's so to stop them, I'll, you know, if they're in their collars, I'll recall them out of the play. If they're not in their collars, I'll have to go and step in. Sometimes I have to get the little 3-foot dressage whip to kind of give some checks on the hindquarter. I'll settle them on, I'll send them into place for a while and let them kind of just, you know, come out. They can come off their place. I don't release them off the place, but if they come out of it hot, then I'll send them back. So if they come off place on their own and they go right back into the play, I'll step back in and send them back to place. That's what I'm doing for those two. A lot of it, I let it play out to, it's just, again, it's a fine line. You got to figure out. When those dogs come in, you know, I have to have some control, obviously, before I let them socialize. Otherwise, it's, I have to have some sort of reputation with the dog. So if I have like three that have a pretty good, they're in a good groove and a new one comes in, that one's going to be on the long line initially. But, you know, my dog Hazel's really insecure and she, when the dogs get in her space, she kind of fires up on them. She's never done any damage. It always scares the crap out of me because it's so loud when she does it. But she may come away with a tuft of fur. I found that if I went after her for doing that, then she didn't want to be out in the socials anymore. And that's a big lesson for me, is that if I don't let her express herself, because she's not doing anything other than asking for space. But when she would do that, it'd scare the crap out of me early on. I'd go, Hazel! And I'd like yell at her and she'd get airplane ears and like want to leave. You know, and I'm like, so now because I let her kind of express that, and if she, sometimes she'll keep firing on the dog because it's not moving away fast enough from her, but she's not making contact. It's just fang banging. And except for she comes out a tuft of fur. But So for her, I want to let her be able to be comfortable out there that she can yell at a dog if it's getting in her space. One of the Weimaraners, my husky Juno, just was standing in front of him, and he is a really insecure dog, and he just lit in the Juno and pulled a big tuft of fur out of him. But Juno just backed up and did a, you know, a husky howl, and he's a very confident dog, and the other dog's insecure. I know how that's going to go. You know, I know Juno's not going to reciprocate when a dog does that to him. So that one, I just kind of, I wish I had it on video because it's pretty funny.
I love some of the phrases you used there. I've got to steal some of those, like airplane ears and fang banging. But something you said was kind of interesting to me, you know, about how at first with, I forgot your dog's name that you were talking about the first time.
Hazel.
Hazel, yeah. That like, it was sort of a lesson for you that if you sort of got on her for, you know, firing up a little bit, that it kind of shut her down or made her want to leave the space, and you had to sort of learn to let it go. And I think that alone is such a potent lesson. But I'm curious, in your experience, have you ever noticed or do you ever find that instead of like correcting her, that if she learns or as she learns that you will, you know, kind of back her up or advocate for her or ensure that other dogs don't sort of push her too far. Have you noticed at all, like, will she soften the way she expresses herself? Like, she still expresses herself, but have you ever found that she starts to do it in, or that other dogs perhaps will start to do it in a more subtle manner as they learn to trust in your control over the social group?
Yeah, well, you know, I will, if I see them moving. Well, the problem with Hazel, she'll freeze. And this is what, this is the freeze is a conflict between flight and fight. Right. And that's what, she was always that way. And the way I fixed that initially, which I probably should go back to it, is I had her on her collar, and when she would freeze, I'd recall her. So I'd recall her out of the situation. So the more I did that, the less she would freeze. Cause she says, oh, I have an out. I can leave the scenario.
So you're almost like teaching her to engage the flight response more productively.
Through a directional like recall. So you're breaking the freeze through a recall, which is then becomes a flight behavior, so to speak, you know, versus a flight of, you know, I'm going to get out of here because he yelled at me. That's a completely different one. So my old dog Hoku was very similar. I did the same thing because she was a freeze dog. And so
it's almost like you're teaching her how to self-soothe in a way.
Just resolve conflict resolution. Like you have an option. It's a big yard. You can leave the situation, but she does, she'll freeze and you can see her just standing there, like, and the tail starts to scorpion up, you know, and you're like, I'm recalling her, and her brain just, and she has really strong recall, but in those scenarios, it's just the freeze is much stronger. And so it's probably a good thing to put her collar back on so I can interrupt that with a recall instead of, like, I wouldn't correct that freeze. You wouldn't want to do that. You would want to break it and by recalling her out of it. So her brain goes, oh, I'll just go to this side of the yard. You know, now if that dog pursues her, then I'm going to intervene and I will shut that dog down and redirect him. And so then she'll say, okay, I'm more inclined to be out in the yard, you know, if she sees that, you know, so she's a tricky little dog, you know?
Yeah. I always say it sort of like, you know, she is shouting. And you're using that recall or that you know, teaching her to walk away as sort of like almost like teaching her to whisper her needs instead of shouting them, right? Like use that disengaging from the dog as a form of communication to say, like, hey, I'm not interested right now. And then when you said, like, if the other dog pursues, that you'll then intervene with that dog. So it's kind of like communicating to Hazel that she should attempt to whisper first. And even if the other dog doesn't listen to her whispers, that you're listening to her whispers,
right?
And that she can sort of trust that. Cause I find that if dogs feel like, hey, when I whisper, nobody ever pays attention anyway, then they just go, I might as well just shout from the get go.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
The only thing that ever works. Right.
Right. That's the same with like reactive dogs, you know, a lot of times that reactivity starts with whining and then nobody addresses that emotion, that cue. Right. And the dog might go to the barking and it keeps going up, and then the dog lunges, and guess what? That dog moves on. So the dog goes, well, I'm not going to do all this stuff down here because nobody ever paid attention to it.
Yeah.
They'll pay attention to me lunging. So a lot of times when you have a reactive dog and you bring them way away from dogs, they show you the very first symptom that they probably showed the owners initially, which was I'm concerned about a dog, or my brow is furrowed, like the bane. I guess she was reactive to dogs, but she sees dogs on the walks and she gets furrowed. And so right there, I have to start communicating with her. You know, for her, I just put her into a sit right now, because if I'm telling her to leave it or heal, she just stays furrowed. So I just, with her, she's a dog that I can go, okay, sit. Let's look at the picture. Watching the dog pass by, she's not blowing up. She's just observing this thing going by. And once everything softens, I'm like, all right, now we move again. That works for that dog, right? Some dogs, you can't do that when they're highly reactive. You can't ask them to be static. You have to say, you know, we need to keep moving.
Yeah. But I think the bigger picture is that regardless of what we're asking them to do, we are responding to the more subtle communication that they're offering.
Oh yeah. Initially. Yeah. You always want to be that on that side of it, because then, like you said, you're just, then every big thing becomes much more quieter line of
communication. Exactly. And I think that's
something like when I see her like being okay, my thing is I want to see a little bit of the freeze. So she, cause you want the dog to feel that like, oh shit moment, but not to have it build where the body language, the tail and everything.
Yeah.
You want to have that like, oh crap. And then recall. So their brain goes, oh yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. You don't want it to build so strong that you're having to increase the collar level. And then that way, that's how you get off the collar on something like that, because you're catching it at such a soft moment. You're using a very soft level to break her out of that state. But I think they need to feel that moment where they're like, I'm starting to freeze. And you go, hey, let's go this way. Right.
Now, so you said two things there that I want to touch on, actually. So one is what you're saying right now about this idea of you want the dog to sort of be in a predicament, right? Like they feel that pressure of the other dog's presence, right, so that you can show them how to get out of that. And that's something that I think, you know, is worth thinking about with almost any kind of training that has to do with any kind of pressure, whether it's e-collar pressure or just the sort of social or psychological pressure of being in a group of dogs or whatever it is, where our job as trainers is to help the dog problem solve or teach the dog how to problem solve, or like you said, conflict resolution. But it's hard for the dog to learn to solve a problem if they don't even know that the problem exists yet. And I think sometimes, like I notice when I'm working with dog owners and even when I'm working with other professionals, we're a little bit too quick to solve the problem for the dog, and the dog didn't even know there was an issue. Like right. I see it sometimes with e-collar, where sometimes early on, trainers are so adamant about being on like the lowest possible level that the dog doesn't even know the collar is worth paying attention to.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean? And, but it doesn't have to be e-collar. It could be absolutely anything. But the other thing that you touched on that I think is just so powerful, and I think for anybody who's at home watching this or listening to this, who is dealing with a aggressive dog, reactive dog, whatever, is that idea of like our job is to basically have this conversation with the dog where we're saying, hey, I know in the past I didn't do a good job of listening to your subtle cues, like the furrowed brow you mentioned with the Dane,
right,
or anything else. But now, like, that's changing now. I'm going to start doing a better job of listening and noticing when you're trying to tell me something so that you don't have to shout about it. And I think, you know, again, there's so many different ways that we could respond to those subtle communications, and that may be a little bit beyond this conversation and can vary from dog to dog. But I think just that concept that you touched on there, I think if people can really hear that about, again, like if you're dealing with reactivity and aggression, that's your job. That's the first conversation you need to have with your dog, is to say, hey, I may have missed these cues in the past. I'm not missing them now. And build that trust for your dog, to trust that you're going to actually hear the things that they're saying. And that rapport, that trust that you can build by being more responsive, is just so potent and powerful.
Yeah, I think that I learned, I mean, it goes back to like that reactivity thing too, I think too, where people, like you were saying, can be quick on the button or quick on the correction or something. And I've had this where dogs are getting kind of hammered every time they look at a dog. And you're just like, well, now you're really going to screw this dog up, because you have to like bring him out of the scenario a couple times and then say, okay, how do you feel about this dog now? And you have to let the dog, how is the dog going to learn to look at a dog if every time somebody's on him for looking at a dog, you know, because people are like, well, he's really bad, so he can't look at any dogs. It's like, well, that's impossible. And that's what I mean. Like people, you know, that's why I want to let him look at a dog once you've gone through some scenarios. And he's like, well, how does he feel about this dog? The brows may furrow, but then it may soften very quickly too, based on the repetitions you were doing. But I learned, kind of really focused on this when I had my ranch with reactive dogs, because I didn't have a park. You know, I didn't have a lot of dogs around me up there. I had my own dogs. And so I reserved them for these reactive dogs until I had good foundation on recall, healing, leave it commands. And then I would present my dogs at distance. So I would be out in my field and let that dog out on a long line. And the minute it'd see my dogs, I would say, okay, that's the first threshold. And I'm letting the dog pull out ahead of me. I'm like, you can go out there on your own and take on the world, right? Because again, you're capitalizing on that insecurity of that dog. You're saying, if you want to be out there, go ahead. The minute I hear something from that dog, a whine or a fixation, that's the moment where I'm like, okay, that's the whisper, like you're saying. Right there, I recall the dog back. And I want him to start to realize safety is here. And if you want to go back out there on your own, and what I'll find is that if I do that, then the dog doesn't want to move out from me. So now we move together and we find the next threshold where that dog shows that same symptom again, that whining, and then you recall him back. Typically, I would be able to get most dogs up on my fence line and start walking parallel with my dogs and having those dogs in a heel when I did that. It just depends on how strong the behavior was. But that's where I kind of really started to tap into that, where that's why I do so much on the long line, because I want that dog to kind of disconnect from me in the beginning to realize, hey, it's actually really feels better being backed by the handler, you know?
Yeah. I want to jump to a question that came in on the stream, because Sage asked this question that a bunch of people were like, oh yeah, me too. Like I'm dealing with the same kind of stuff. So Sage, which is, I believe, Angela Faith from the group, you know, she's been working with her dog for a bit now, and she's still trying to kind of understand Sage's drives. So she's noticing out in her walks, lots of prey drive, like nose to the ground kind of stuff, and then some defense, but then, you know, a lot of reactions to dogs on the leash. So she's just wondering, like, because like, I know I've heard you talk about like reactivity kind of loads up in prey drive, but obviously when people are watching it, it looks like this very defensive behavior. So I know we've talked about this a bit in the past, but like when you're looking at the average leash reactive dog, like how do you describe that from a drive standpoint, using the sort of drive theory that you subscribe to?
Those dogs are typically, well, I've had three confident dogs in my life. Juno's my third one. Neither have been reactive. So, you know, watch the dogs that come in, because they're generally the insecure dogs.
Yeah.
That are reactive. They're not confident. And so,
and that lacking confidence, that's usually means like those low confident dogs, does that mean they're higher defense? Is that how that works? I always mix that up.
It's going to be a lower defense dog.
Okay. So yeah. Low confidence is lower defense.
Lower defense. Yeah. High confident dogs. Juno's a very high confident dog. He doesn't go into flight at all. Or if he does, it's like 6 inches to a foot if you get spooked. You know, so that's the dogs that are usually, and the ones that have high prey drive coupled with that low defense, that insecurity, those are even harder, because they're, that prey drive adrenaline is for forward movement, right? Mm-hmm. Then flight, you have adrenaline in flight, but that's for running away from danger.
Yeah.
But these dogs that are high prey driven, low in defense, insecure, they're typically they're forward loaded more via adrenaline. And so that's where you always have to kind of get a hold of that download. Yeah. Because they make poor decisions when they're adrenalized, you know, unless
as we all do.
Yeah, right. Unless you've trained as a Navy SEAL or a Belgian Malinois or, you know, whatever, the sport. Because those dogs are operating in a high state of adrenaline, but they're very controlled. But look how much work it takes to get that.
Yeah.
Right. But these insecure dogs, those are the ones I like do a lot of recall off of dogs initially, because then their brain, when they're coming back into you, their adrenaline is shutting down, right? They can't adrenalize on something they can't see. Mm-hmm. Right. And so if I built my relationship with them in a kind of quiet context or in an open field without a lot of dogs, and I say, okay, now we're going to go and I'll take you into this environment, by then we have a lot of trust. So then when I let them see a dog and start to move out from me, that's where I start. That's where you start making like a bigger connection with the dog. Cause all of a sudden you'll see them just go, I don't feel good going out there, cause their adrenaline's starting to rise, you know? And so when I call them back in, their adrenaline's coming down and they're going in the pack drive. So that, I mean, you don't have behaviors in pack drive. You don't have bad behaviors in pack drive when you really stop and think about it, unless a dog is in a sit, but it's fixated on something that's not really in pack drive.
Yeah.
Right. But pack drive, they're very soft. They're connected with you. They're checking in. So generally I would think all bad behaviors are either going to be when a dog's in a prey drive or in defense drive, whether it's a flight or a fight behavior, you know, but a lot of those reactive dogs are probably low defense. I would say probably higher in fight than they are in, I mean, higher in flight than they are in fight. Hazel's very high flight, but when she freezes, she'll kick in the fight quicker because that, in her brain, that works. It gets the dog to move away.
Now I'm curious, because you do a lot of, you are a trainer. You work with dog owners who bring their dogs to you for help, but you also do a lot of mentoring with other professionals. And I know for me, there are things that I think, like technical things that I think are really important for a professional trainer to understand that maybe I don't necessarily want the average dog owner to like spend too much time worrying about. Like, I just kind of want them to, hey, this is what your dog's doing right now. This is what you need to do. So on and so forth. So when we talk about like these drives for somebody like Sage, like how crucial is it, do you think, for Angela to like really have a sound understanding of those drives? Or do you think it's enough to just say like, hey, your dog's probably kind of aroused and getting adrenalized, but also this is probably stemming from insecurity. And sort of here are some strategies, like, you know, these are some things that will help. Like, cause right. Sometimes I find that people can get really hung up on language and I need to understand what this term means and what drive is this, what's behind this. And it sort of prevents them from just sort of doing what needs to be done.
No, I agree. I mean, I'm sure you don't explain the quadrants to your clients.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I'm thinking about. Yeah.
No, I don't. It's like, I put it in a layman term.
Yeah.
For the client. But when students are here, you know, they really want to understand that concept more and like a deeper, you know, so like a circumstance, like, there was a student here and his dog, we were trying to doctor her ear and she would run into the crate to avoid, you know, cleaning the ear. And he would go in there and get her and pull her out. And she got away again. And she went in there and I was like, okay, well, let's stop for a second and let's look at this. I said, what drive is she in? Well, she went into flight and now she's in the crate and you're going in to get her and she's in, you know, in defense, right? So, you know, a dog sitting there like that is in defense drive. So what are their options when they're cornered? Fight or flight, right? Now I can't go into flight. So a dog will either freeze or shut down or they'll fight. This dog wasn't going to do any of them, but I said, let's, for instance, how can we get her out of there? Other than fishing her out while she's in defense, she has high prey drive. Reached up, got a bag of treats, shook them. She came out of the crate, petted her up, put her in a sit, doctored her ear, gave her the food. So we basically switched her out of defense by bringing the food in, which then switched her into prey drive to come out of the kennel. So see, then we brought her out of defense that way. Now, if the dog had a strong recall, we probably could have recalled her out, you know, to come out of the kennel. But it's just, that's what I like to show the students. So their brain gets kind of more wrapped around, hey, how can I get this dog change this behavior? Well, a lot of it is you got to switch the drive, you know, but yeah. For my clients, it's just like, no, the dog's anxious or whatever. So we need to recall the dog. We need to send it to place or, you know, whatever the case might be. But I don't get that. Although it's pretty funny that some clients have, the guy with the Weimaraner wrote me this long text before they came in and he was saying all of his dogs drive, this dog's drive is this. So he must've been watching videos or something.
Yeah.
So he kind of latched on. I mean, clients latch onto it if they read it on the website because it's more tangible. It's very simple, you know, to some degree than saying, oh, it's the energy or something, because that's not tangible.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, energy is definitely critical by all means, but I think when you have something that's more tangible, they can kind of say, oh, that makes sense. You know, but defense drive is always a tricky one to wrap your head around.
Yeah, yeah.
Because a lot of dogs that are in a fight behavior most likely are higher in flight anyways, but they learned fighting resolves the issue. That's why people will see me a lot of times when I'm long lining for the first time on a dog. I'll take the line, I'll have a couple loops, and as the dog passes by, I'll crack it onto my leg and it makes a loud pop, or I'll crack it on top of the line when there's tension on the line. And then 99% of the time it startles those dogs and they go into a flight, and I let them have the line and then I work them back into me. I work them out of that flight. Mm-hmm. So they don't know. It wasn't like a correction per se. It was just a sound.
Like an interruption.
There's an interruption or reverberation down the line. Sometimes dogs, like I had a Dane that would charge at me and try to bite me and I'd hold him off, and then he'd run away and go after his owner. Then he came back to me, and the second time as he started to run away, I cracked him on the hindquarters and he took off. And I said, that's what he needs to know right now. That's the behavior he needs to know now, is to go into flight, zero conflict, go into flight, work him back. He never did it again. But he learned that that behavior was unstoppable. It worked for him. So you had to put him, even though he was in defense fight, I had to send him into a flight behavior.
Yeah.
And then I worked him back in the pack drive through the long line work. And when that happens, majority of the time, that dog's just like, oh, okay, you're awesome.
You know, it's so interesting. Every time I talk to you, I'm always kind of amazed. Like, there are so many similarities between what you do, but we describe it so differently, or we kind of get to the end kind of same thing, but from a different angle. And when you're talking about this kind of idea of like switching the dog out of that defense into flight, you know, I talk a lot about like how important it is to find the right correction. And especially for these reactive dogs that, like you mentioned, also are so forward seeking from that adrenaline. You know, I talk about that a lot, how that pattern with a lot of these reactive dogs is like something stimulates them and they want to launch. And I talk about how it's so important to find a correction that puts them in that retreating state of mind, that's it's the opposite of the forward movement. We want to kind of make them go backwards. I don't necessarily describe it as switching them from defense drive to prey drive, but really what I'm talking about is the same exact thing. And I always love that when I talk to you, that it's always like, we kind of always come to the same conclusions. And I'm curious because, you know, I've spent a lot of time working with like performance, like sport dog trainers and stuff like that. And it's not uncommon to see people do like drive switching activities where like put a dog into like really intense prey drive and then like make sure they can kind of switch them out of that into a more social drive, or go into like play, like tug, like really intense, like tug of war drive or bite work, and then be able to switch them back to where the dog will take food, where that tug is like that super high adrenaline. And then the food is like that lower state.
That's all.
I used to do a similar thing.
That's all in the prey drive.
Yeah, those two are still prey drive, but right? I used to do a similar thing with Lobo, where like I'd put him, like when I would exercise him, there's a video somewhere, I think I actually show it in the reactivity rehab webinar, of him on the slat mail, and I use prey drive, I use his tug toy to motivate him to run,
right.
And then I tell him to out, and then I make sure I can kind of switch him back into social mode, and I want his eye contact back to me, and I want him to soften and pet, and I can hold the tug toy, but he's kind of looking at me. And like, do you find with a lot of the stuff that you're doing with drive switching, that is like a skill that can be practiced, and that the more you sort of help a dog learn how to transition from one drive to another, that they actually get better at it? Like, is that something that you look for in your training?
Yeah. I mean, that's, well, because again, it's, you know, these behaviors that they're going into, defense is not, it can't feel good.
Yeah.
To go in defense. And it can't feel good to be at the upper red line level of a predatory drive with all that adrenaline rushing in. You know, I've had dogs that have been obsessed with the ball, and the owners say this dog's obsessed with the ball. I'm like, okay, great. Guess what? That dog doesn't see a ball for a week. Yeah. Maybe.
It's like an addiction. It's right. Like an OCD.
So what I noticed is that I taught this dog all this, how to feel calm in these certain scenarios. And then when I would bring the ball out and they would see it, you would see them just load up, you know, because just that ball alone loads that drive. But with these dogs, it loads it really high. And I would throw it. And after a couple of throws, the dog would like kind of go out and just stop on the third one and go, and it would come back to me. And it's like, and part of me is just like, it's almost like they don't want to go that to that realm again. You know what I mean? Where you've shown them what it feels like to be calm. And then you're cycling in and out different levels of prey drive. Maybe you're bringing food in. Maybe you're doing long line work around squirrels. So their prey drive is surging. And then you're bringing them down and packing them in again. And so you're showing these dogs like these different levels of prey drive versus this one and this one, the maximum overdrive one, the one that the dog's in a lot. You have to kind of show them all these different levels. And then I'll see dogs almost self-regulate. And I'd see that with dogs where you throw the ball and they'll go after it a couple of times. Third time, they kind of spit it out and go, I don't like the taste of that. Yeah, and what I think it is, it's like, I don't like the feel of that adrenaline that's starting to load up. Yeah. For 7 days, I didn't feel that. Now I've got dogs, it's a detox. I've gotten them back into it. Like I quit drinking years and years ago and I didn't go down to the local bar to have lunch.
Yeah.
You know, that would have been counterproductive. But now, like if I go by and I see like whatever my poison was or something, I'll look at that and go, I just go, it wouldn't feel good.
Yeah.
I'd rather, you know, have my kava or not. Kava is like a root thing. It's not a champagne that people get mixed up with, but you know what I mean? So I can look at that and have that feeling of how would I feel if I went down that road?
Yeah.
And then it's just a reminder. It's like, I don't want to go down that road, but now I can get some of those dogs to go back into retrieving maybe with a different toy, with a lesser association, like a bumper, you know, and then you can teach them if they retrieve the bumper, it's usually easy to teach them to find the bumper. And then now you have two different modes.
I remember when I was in California with you, when we were filming you and Sherry, there was a dog there that was like way in overdrive playing fetch.
Yeah.
And you talked about, instead of just like throwing the ball on like open ground, you know, tossing it into long grass where the dog has to hunt and kind of using that so that the game is a little bit more cognitive and slows the dog down a little bit. And just like a different degree of that prey drive expression.
Well, it's more, I mean, if you throw it, the dog's punching from 0 to 100, right? And it's all triggered by movement. But if you go out and you hide it, which we were doing for that shepherd while he was holding place, and then you send them, they come out of the blocks hot, but they have to slow down.
Yeah.
Otherwise they'll lose the scent.
Yeah.
So it becomes more cerebral.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. For them. And it's keeping the adrenaline just kind of doing this, you know, oh, there it is. And then they lose the scent and it lowers back down again. But that's the thing that similarities, I asked you about that. And I said, this is a suppression that we're doing, right? By holding the dog on place. And I remember asking you, I said, when you put a dog in an agitation harness, I said, wouldn't you consider that suppression? You go, no, it's frustration, right? But the end goal was the same, because you want to build that drive for the dog to go get their bumper. You want to build that intensity for them to hit the sleeve or whatever. But also, you know, I can hold a dog back if I'm holding Lobo and you're calling them and I won't let him go, I'm suppressing the pack drive, or you would refer to it as like a restricted recall, probably.
Yeah, restrained recall, yeah.
Restrained recall. So dog trying to go, you're suppressing the pack drive, but it's not bad because you're building that desire to get to the handler and then you let him go.
Building up the potential energy.
Right. Bad suppression would be a dog that's reactive and it's in flight and you're restraining him from going into flight through a lot of pressure through a prong or whatever, and you say, I want you to heal today. The dog's like, I can't, I'm in flight. Well, you're suppressing a flight behavior. Then if he's reactive and the dog comes around, this is where you can get a redirection, because now there's it used to be called frustration redirection.
Yeah.
Right. You're suppressing flight. You're suppressing the prey. And then the dog is now frustrated and goes after the handler. That's a common, you know, thing that happens sometimes. That's why I let the dogs out and let them kind of go into the flight or go into that movement and recall them and pack them back in.
Hey listeners, just a quick reminder. These podcasts are created from archived recordings of live sessions where members of our community can ask questions and interact with our instructors in real time. If you'd like to be part of the discussion, visit ConsiderTheDog.com and use code CTDPODCAST to get 50% off your first 3 months. That's 3 months for $10 a month, and you have access to not only these live sessions, but also our library of hundreds of exclusive videos and courses on dog behavior. Again, visit ConsiderTheDog.com and use code CTDPODCAST. Let's get back to the show.
There's a question here I want to jump to on the stream while we still have time, because it's kind of an intense, or a more intense one. It came in from Maureen. So she's asking for advice related to a human aggressive bulldog. The dog's name is Tank. It says he attacks all humans when he's in the presence of his family. So there's two teens and mom and dad at home or on the leash. He has some trauma. He was adopted 6 months ago after bouncing around from shelters and rescues, ended up in a shelter after his owner was murdered during a break-in. I'm assuming witnessed the murder. It was a gunshot. So he's muzzle trained now. He's got a solid place command and recall. After months of work, he can now hold a place when a guest enters the house, but mom still can't take her eyes off him. He'll go after the guest if he can. Recently came to Maureen's house when the family was out of town, and she had no issues at all with him there, with no muzzle. He was totally fine, but returned to treating her even like a stranger once he was back in her own home. So she's asking, like, you know, would a board and train be effective here? I could see why that could be in question if the dog behaves so differently in the house. But then also just in general, like, what's our starting point with a dog like this? You know, what's the starting point? And then I guess I would also like to know, like, just sort of like, what's the big picture? Like, what's the, you know, what's sort of the framework that we're operating in here?
Yeah, there's a lot of moving parts in that.
Yeah.
In that case.
That's why I wanted to ask it while we had time. I figured it might take a minute to dig into.
Funny. I had a small dog and, you know, he's bigger now, but he had I did the resource guarding video I sent to you. That resource guarding protocol video I sent for Consider the Dog. I don't know if it was ever put up or not.
I believe so. Yeah.
So that dog would lean on the owner a lot, you know, and I told them, I said, you can't let him do this. You can't let him do this. I said, this dog has a propensity to be a resource guarder, which that can carry over into guarding people, guarding homes, guarding space. Unfortunately, he has bitten 5 people now. And he didn't have that behavior when he came in. And so when I go to the house to kind of see what's going on, he's all over the wife. You know, he's leaning on her, he's sitting on her feet. So that was never clearly resolved. So I'm going to have to go back. Now he's doing it out on walks. I don't know if it's just solely with the woman or not. But when I went over there, he had intentions to come after me. He didn't recognize me. But once we just started saying, no, this is what he knows. He knows recall and he knows the place. There was a pallet. I said, put him on that pallet and tell him place. That dog, the minute he had 2 reps and he started to feel nervous about me, he started moving away and going over there on the pallet on his own. So again, if you restrain a dog on place, I've seen this with my own clients, that if that dog, is that dog back tied on place? That's a good question. I don't know if he is or isn't. Is she live or no?
I think she's live. So Maureen, yeah, if you're still here, feel free to type in.
But if
he's a little bit of a delay, but
if they're back tied and they don't understand back tied pressure, as we just discussed, that can create frustration, right? So that dog can feel like a suppression, you know, and that's what happened with one of my clients.
In a bad way, you're talking about.
What's that?
Depression in a bad way there. Yeah,
exactly. But it means the same thing, right? The dog's getting wound up to go after somebody coming in. That's bad.
Yeah.
For a bite sleeve work and stuff like that, that's good because it's a different context, right? So when I walked into my client's house and their dog was on the place back tied, he's like losing his shit. I just go, let him go. Because what that dog had to experience was charging the door, right? Maximum stress, call him off the door, back to the place. He never was back on a leash again. And we let the dog cycle through this probably 3 times. And he finally like just laid down next to everybody and just went, okay, I'm done with this.
Yeah.
So, again,
she actually said they tried a back tie, but he got frustrated. So
right.
Yeah.
So for me, it's a tough breed too, to be honest. Yeah.
And they can be very, like we talked about, like dogs who are obsessed, like bulldogs get very obsessive about things like this.
Yeah. The Frenchies, Bostons. And once they get locked in on something, it's pretty challenging to get them to say, hey, you can let that go now. But I don't like some of the exercise I probably would try with them. And I don't know if she has, is if he's targeting people coming in, that I would have him on a long line and I would do the recall. If he's targeting somebody, it's going back to like the whispering stuff again, right? Those dogs are super hard to read and they tend to blow out really quick. You know, they don't show a whole lot of, they're kind of this mm-hmm. and then they're gone. And you're like, did I just miss that? In those scenarios with those dogs, I always say when in doubt, there's no doubt, just call them off. You know, if you can't read the dog, and again, some dogs have such a short fuse that you have to go, I'm not going to wait for him to go. I'm just going to call him out. Maybe it was the fuse was burning. I don't know. But the thing is that you have to create a longer fuse with those dogs. And so by the way I would do that with them is I would let them go into the behavior, but I'm not correcting the behavior. I'm saying, because again, it's a stressor. So I don't want to add stress to the stress. So it goes back to like, let him go into it or let him think about going into it, calling him back, sending him to place. Hmm. And let his brain settle on there. Now and it might be.
But when you do the place thing, like you said, like if the dog breaks, you don't necessarily like correct them immediately for breaking the place. You'll let them do whatever they were going to break and do, and then bring them out of that.
Right.
Is that correct?
Because if your place is established where it's a calm, like the dogs go into a calm state there, they understand that going on place is not a behavioral sort of, it's not a obedient sort of thing. It's more emotional, get on there,
go chill out. Yeah.
And chill. If the dog understands that, like the big Weimaraner I have here, there's squirrels that run all around my yard. He was obsessed. Now he still looks at them. And from time to time, they come in a little hot, but he's almost going to his place a lot on his own when he's starting to get overstimulated. Cause that's what I've been doing with them. It's like, okay, you're too overstimulated. Come back, go to your place. There's a couple of different ones in the yard there. And I'll look around and he'll be sitting on his place watching the squirrel, like softly watching the squirrel, not fixating. So he's now kind of making a choice on his own where he's, again, he's reached that level of adrenaline where it's not feeling good to him. He knows, hey, if I go here 15 feet away from the fence line and get on my place, I'll be less intense. That's what I mean. You cycle the dog in and out of those things. And bulldogs are just much harder because they just get more, you know, bulldog on a skateboard, bulldog on a trampoline, bulldog. I mean, doesn't
the hose. The hose is a big one with them. Oh my God.
It doesn't take much for those dogs to become obsessed with something.
Yeah. So kind of what I'm hearing, it sounds almost like, and you know, Maureen, you can maybe correct me if I'm wrong here, but maybe like when we say that like mom has to kind of watch him like a hawk, that maybe if she is right now sort of watching him and making sure he stays on place and sort of that maybe loosening up there and you know, he's muzzled and make sure that, you know, whoever's there is obviously comfortable with whatever's going to happen. Obviously if they're not, then maybe it's not the best time to practice this, but you know, instead of sort of micromanaging my place, kind of loosening up that rule, letting him go into that expression of whatever he's going to do and then bring him back and then bring him onto place. And Brian, I'm kind of curious. So
I would add to that, Tyler, if the dog is back tied, it needs to understand the back tie pressure and how to shut that off.
Yeah. I think I think she stopped back tying him from what it sounds like here in the comments.
But I wouldn't rule that altogether. Maybe the dog was getting frustrated because it didn't understand the back tie.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The oppositional reflex dog didn't understand that. So you have to use spatial pressure to move them back onto the place with maybe e-collar pressure. And so the dog shuts the back tie pressure off. So then his brain will kind of understand, don't get frustrated, back up to shut it off.
Yeah. Yeah. And she said that, that she thinks she's on the right track with kind of the stuff you're saying. She said she's sort of the quote crash dummy. And so Tank breaks place and mom calls him back when he reaches Maureen, but she doesn't wait for him to go totally ballistic and explode. I'm kind of curious. So when we're talking about all this stuff and letting the dog break place and recall back, how important for you is it to have that place established before doing any of this, or to have the place kind of part of it from the beginning versus, for instance, maybe just putting him on a long line or whatnot and practicing that sort of letting him go out and then recalling him back and then letting him go out and recalling him back until maybe the impulse to go out is a little bit less, and then placing him, then doing the place command? Or do you like to have that place established first and get the dog on the place? You know what I mean? Or does it not matter?
Yeah, so that's
much?
That's a good question. So when I'm starting place, you know, and the dogs are kind of getting it and understanding it, then I will do anything I can to get that dog to break place. So whether you're overstimulating with a ball or letting another dog out and run around, or I'm excitedly going in and talking to the dog or petting the dog, and you're increasing these spikes of adrenaline so the dog will break. Like some dogs, you reward them with food and they go, that's awesome, I'm going to come get more from you. Now I'm spiking that adrenaline up, right? And then the dog breaks and I put it back. So I'm looking for anything I can to get the dog to break on a high level. So then I can go, okay, go back, let them reset on the place, so let their brain kind of cycle back down again. And so when you create this like contrast of feeling of how do you feel here? And then now I'm going to create an excitatory, you know, action, whether it's food or whatever, throwing a ball or some trigger to get the dog goes, oh, I want to do that. And he breaks. Then I just set them back again. So that's how I get them to understand, oh, when I'm on here, I feel this way. Mm. If you don't create that contrast, then they don't get that. So like the Weimaraner, when he was ramped up on the squirrels, I have a good recall with him. Recall him, set him to place. I would back tie him initially. Part of what I do when I have a really good control of the group now that I have, I'll let them play. And if they start getting super excited, which we'll go back to Jay's thing too, when they get super ramped up, I call them all out, send them all to place. And they, within like 2 minutes, they're just like, they're chilled and they're like back on place again. And then once they're totally down, I'll quietly release them and they come out and they start socializing again. And they'll like see what the levels are. Sometimes they'll play and then they'll break it off themselves. So again, I'm always looking for creating like some sort of excitement, letting them ride in that for a while, 10%, 20%, and then 80, 90% on place where their brain is completely in a calm state.
Mm-hmm.
And so you just
so in theory, like for the sake of like kind of generalization, or, you know, I always like to kind of make things approachable for people's different styles of training or whatever might work for them. Like in theory, it wouldn't necessarily have to be placed. Like for instance, in the Facebook group, there's often a lot of discussion about different protocols for teaching dogs to relax. And some of them are like rub downs and massage therapy. Some of them are like Mark McCabe does like what he calls a behavioral down. I've talked about Emily Larlam has a protocol for teaching dogs to settle. So in theory, like if you have a way to reliably that the dog knows, hey, when we do this, it means relax. You could use that thing in lieu of place, for instance. Like if you've done behavioral downs and your dog does it well and understands it well, and it means to your dog, go into a calm, relaxed sort of feel right. good, chill space. You could recall your dog out of that, you know, situation they're in, and then possibly do a behavioral down.
Yeah. For me, if I create place to be that calm state and a dog goes into a down on there, say I'm having a challenging time teaching a down. If I just back tie the dog and let him have about a foot of slack to make a mistake to come off, and yeah. I just pressure him back on with spatial pressure, maybe I'll add the e-collar pressure. He backs up, he gets on. I don't care if he's sitting, standing, or laying down. But if that dog finally decides I'm going to lay down, I can capture that down.
Yeah. Well, I'm just right. saying more like in the context of maybe somebody's doing this stuff and maybe they
but
don't,
if I take them to place,
their dog doesn't know place, but they have a different thing they do that yeah. creates relaxation. They have a different right. exercise that gets to that end goal of relaxation. And rather than saying, well, you've got to teach place, it's got to be the place. It could be a different thing that accomplishes right. that same goal of triggering the dog back into sort of a more neutral or calmer or less adrenalized state of mind.
Yeah.
Like you can recall the dog out. And if you have another way that doesn't involve place, but of getting them to that relaxed state, you could do that instead.
Well, the reason why place is because it's very defined when the dog is out of that zone and not, or when he's
got
on it. right? Because we have this elevation, right? And it's very clear delineation when he is out of the boundary. So that's why that helps create that. Now, if I get a down on there where the dog's relaxed, I can take him off of that. And because it's generalized on place, then I take him into the yard and I ask for the down there. It may take a few reps, but then you'll see the brain switch going, oh yeah, my down is this.
Yeah.
And I ask him in a park and I ask him at a cafe, but the down was conditioned on the place because the place represented a calm state, right? And yep. If I waited for the dog to go into a down on its own, he's not going into a down excited. No dog really does. They just finally go into a down where they're like, I can't get off the place. So I'm just going to lay down. So their brain is actually ramping down. I'll go in there and massage them in the chest. I'll massage them down their spine when they're in downs, you know, and intensify that. So that's probably like what some of the other people are doing. They're just, again, they're coming at it from a different way. Maybe they're teaching a down and then they're doing the massage or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right. So once the dog is in that state, then I'm going to go and intensify it with the hands-on work, you know, and then you take it out of that generalized area and then you start putting them in those sits. If I teach to sit on the place and the dog's calm on there. So everything is framed in that context of calmness on place.
Yeah. So real quick.
So
this comment came in from Jake Keisha. Jake Keisha, I think is the username. So, cause it sounds very similar. 3.5-year-old German Shepherd goes bananas at the windows when there's a deer or a squirrel outside. And what they've been doing is sending her to her crate, but they're asking, is there a better way? And it's like, if I understand you correctly, probably your answer would be to do kind of the same thing. You can use the crate. If the crate is taut and the crate is a place where the dog feels safe and can settle down, sure, send the dog to the crate, but don't send them in, then lock them in and whatever else. Like send them in. And if they come out of it, it's the same thing, but you could, for instance, use the crate perhaps instead of a place, crate with the door open instead of a place, if the crate has been taught in the right way.
Yeah.
Is that accurate to assume?
The dog's going in there, feeding the dog in the crate. The dogs were sleeping in the crate. They see that as a like all the board and train dogs, I say, let's go. They go in their dog room, they get in their crates and they lay down. Doesn't mean I'm feeding them, but because that's what they do after we work is they go in there and they relax.
Yeah.
So you're setting the environment up for that. And it's generalized in the crate. You may be able to move that, you know, out into the general pop area of the house and try and condition it on a dog bed or, you know, whatever else, and take that generalized behavior and try and move it maybe just outside of the crate, next to the crate to try and, you know, capture that same behavior there.
Yeah. But really it's essentially the same protocol. So when Jay Keisha says, hey, is there something different to do? Yeah. The same exact thing we're telling Maureen to do. And the same exact, we've talked about this a few times in the past kind of.
Yeah. But I mean, that's the dogs, the shepherd's going in prey drive, bulldog's going more into a defense territorial sort of drive, you know, part of that loads and prey and then it becomes territorial. So you're recalling them out, you're switching them out of that drive. You understand that those drives are the ones that's causing the problem. The pack drive doesn't. So you recall them out of those drives that's causing that stuff and then reset them to place or behavioral down or, you know, or
whatever it is. Yeah.
Whatever it is that's going to bring that adrenaline down, you know?
So when you're doing this, way earlier on the stream, Adam asked, you know, what are ways to manage? I think he meant to say barking. It says balking, which could make sense too, I guess. But I think he meant to say barking on walks and then building confidence in new environments, issues with two different dogs, a 4-month-old and a 6-month-old puppy. And the barking on walks, I'm assuming is, you know, a little bit of reactivity, whether it's towards squirrels or towards other dogs. But if you're on a walk, and I've heard you talk about, you know, using the recall to bring the dog out of that and back into social drive. So what are you doing there? Because obviously on a walk, you don't have a place. So what's your substitute to help create that contrast like you talked about for the dog on the walk versus in the home situation like Maureen's dealing with?
So, you know me, I'm always starting them on the long line, right?
Exactly, yeah.
And so if that dog is barking at something away from me, I'm going to recall it back to me. Right. And then that's going to shut that off. So that would be how I would build my relationship, that when you're next to me, you're safe, just as you're safe going on place. When you're next to me, I can easily address where you're thinking of going before you go there. So like a leave it for me is a blanket statement for, I don't like where you're thinking about going versus I don't like what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't typically want to correct when they're in behavior because it goes back.
You want to catch the intention.
Right. So I want to make sure that I have a leave it that's taught not on what's triggering the barking, but I'll teach it off of benign things first in the yard. They're grabbing the stick, leave it. You know, I'm putting things out there. That's why I deal with resource guarding. I don't say leave it off of a bowl right away. No, you want to build that command. And when I do teach leave it when the dog's in the field, a lot of times I'll put pressure on the line and go leave it. And I'm guiding the dog back to me. So if they're away from me, I'm saying leave it and I'm putting pressure towards me. It's almost like leave it starts to mean come to me, you know, and the dog checks in. So then when you're on, once you build those components, and that's what you have to do. If this is happening on the walk, you have these components built. So you have a good heel without the distraction or the stimulus. Do you have a good leave it that was built not foundationally, not because you're doing it right when the dog's like, okay, now I'm going to take him out and I got him on an e-collar. Now when he barks, I'm going to go leave it. Well, that's not fair in my opinion, because then you're having to yell at the dog.
Yeah.
You know, so again, I always want to work, leave it on benign stuff and then increase it as I go along. So now maybe I bring out high value food. I'm eating a beef stick and I'm like, you want that? Leave it. So, you know what I mean? Does that make sense? So I'm incrementally increasing the level of stimulation. Now, when I go out for a walk, then I can address those things. Say that if the dog's forging out from me and barking, a lot of times if I can't hold the heel and that needs to be shored up later, then I'll let the dog break away from me and I'll do like a 2-3 step recall and bring the dog back into a heel. If that makes sense. So I'll let them forge out on whatever they're barking at. And I just back up and recall them and reposition them back into a heel.
Yeah.
Put them into a sit and see how they feel about that. If they can't handle it, I might back up 2 more feet and find again where the dog is not over the threshold, where then it can kind of analyze it. If it's a puppy, usually they're barking at stuff because it's unfamiliar to them.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes a foot, sometimes 2 feet further away from whatever it is, they might go, oh, all right, it's a clown with a bunch of balloons. Okay, put that in the Rolodex, move on. Right? You want to teach the dogs, you want to give them knowledge of the world, you know? And so I think a lot of times people want to just correct that behavior, but I'm like, yeah, I want it to stop. But sometimes it's like, well, I want the dog to evaluate what that is.
Yeah.
So then he can put that in his Rolodex, just like dog will bark at UPS. If you fix that, he'll bark at FedEx because that truck sounds different. And the mailman is completely different. But it's the same protocol that I would recall him off UPS truck. So eventually that sound doesn't have a threat or there's no meaning to it, right? So that dog has a knowledge of what UPS means. Now he doesn't know what FedEx truck means. Now he doesn't know. So again,
the Amazon truck and everything.
Yeah, I know everybody's. And then the guy in the white van that's delivering crap, you know? So, you know, yeah.
I just love how many similarities there are between the way we work. Cause this concept of like, making sure you've established sort of the building blocks that you need before you try to like build your house of a behavioral solution, I think is just so important. That's kind of exactly what you're touching on here.
Yeah, because that's came from teaching one-on-one courses, like classes with clients, and they like, you know, we're doing one-on-one e-collar stuff and we're building foundation, we're building a relationship, because typically the relationship between that dog and the owner is not good. And so I'm not going to, and they're like, when are we going to deal with my dog's aggression? I said, we are, but we have to build. So my spiel is like, look, we have these components that we need to build before we go into this area and address these things. Ironically, as you build those components, a lot of these behaviors start to soften.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so I said, if you have a good recall, you have a good this, you have a good this, now we're going to go. And we're going to go and proof this stuff. Now we're going to go into environments where we're going to put it to use. And we're going to find out where we're weak, where we're strong, you know, and just kind of go from there. But a lot of times if the client does that, and then I say, okay, now let's go into these areas. Then you show them how to string those components together based on the circumstance. What's the dog doing? Oh, well, he just needs to be reinforced to a heel. Oh, he needs to be recalled away from that into a heel. You know, then you can teach them how to use these six commands or whatever and thread them together for whatever the problem is at that time. Doorbell triggers, that's a recall. Then send him to the place. Now he breaks the place because he's excited. He wants to come see the people. Recall him off the people. Now, if he comes in calmly and wants to be around the people, I don't care. But if he starts to bubble up, then I'm going to say, leave it. You can stay here, but you can't go that direction. Now the dog learns, oh, I can be a part of this.
Yeah. You see, you've established ways to tell him sort of what you agree with and what you disagree with. And this is what I'd prefer from you and so on and so forth.
And that may be something that Maureen can add to that. It's just like, okay, is the bulldog coming in hot to the situation? Then I'm going to yellow card him. He's going to get called out and he's going to go and start from the place again. Now, if he comes off the place quietly, I don't want to release him off the place. That's my goal. I want him to go, okay, how can I get off this place? I keep coming off hot. I keep getting yellow carded and thrown back on the place again.
Yeah.
What if I come off quietly and you'll see him do this and nobody's sending me back?
Yeah. And that's such a major distinction between you talked about, like, is the place taught as an obedience thing versus is it taught as a way to sort of get at a certain state of mind or get at a certain level of energy? Because from an obedience standpoint, we'd be like, no, you never let the dog break place on its own. But we always have to understand our goals and objectives. Yeah. And, you know, for the goal and objective that we're trying to accomplish, like, you know, worrying about the dog staying on place until told break, it might be losing the forest for the trees and might actually be counterproductive for the more important thing we're trying to accomplish, which is teaching this dog just how to self-regulate and how to control their energy level when they're around new people.
Yeah. And I think that if that bull, because that bulldog's muzzled, I would say, look, if he's coming off place in a calmer fashion, I would say he can be dragging a line, but let him come into the group. If he starts to get bubbly, then I might go, hey, leave it and give him a little check, whatever you're using to interrupt that, and see if he kind of tamps himself down, you know? And then if he starts to get a little bit more bubbly, I might say, you know what? I don't want to leave him. I want to decompress him. Let's go. I'll bring him back to place and reset him. That might be something that dog needs more of, like a little bit in with the people, maybe one correction for starting to bubble up. And then it's like, you can read it and go, he's starting to get a little hot. Let's take him away.
Yeah.
And reset them. I mean, I do that with clients when they come see their dog. It's just like, I recalibrate the dog back to the owner. It's pretty phenomenal. I've never shot it on video because I just never remember, but some of these dogs don't want to go next to their owner once I've recalled them off a couple of times because they're so adrenalized when they see them that I'm just keep recalling them off. And eventually they get there and they get up there quietly and then they start bubbling up again. And I go, leave it. And they'll tell the owners, put your hand on the dog. And the dog starts to bubble up and they say, leave it, sit. And they put their hand on the dog. And so they're recalibrating this sight of the owner, the smell of the owner, the sound of the owner, the touch of the owner, all those things trigger excitement in a lot of the dogs.
Yeah.
But now the owner's starting to like be hands-on in the dog, and you'll see dogs sometimes just go, okay, I'm going to leave now. And they just remove themselves from the scenario because they're starting to learn. It's been a week.
They're learning to stay away from the bar. They're learning to stay away from the
club. Exactly. I had a dog where they put the hand on the dog and the dog's like this, like repulsed by it. But I'm like, I go, keep your hand there. And the dog finally goes, oh, I'm not going into that state and your hand's on me.
Yeah. I can go have a burger and just get a soda. I don't need to get hammered on gin and tonics.
But that's what you're capitalizing on in those moments and saying, you know, how do you feel here? How do you feel here?
Yeah.
And typically that's the best way I put a dog back in with their owners. Cause some of these trainers go, I did a board and train and it was a shit show. I'm like, well, yeah, because the dog was over-adrenalized and you're asking it to execute all these behaviors that it can't do in an adrenalized state. You didn't work the dog in that state.
They're focused so much on what the dog is doing and losing sight of how the dog is feeling.
There you go.
Yeah. Yep. I think, you know what, on that note, Brian, I think we're going to wrap up here. All right, it is always a pleasure. I love having you on here. It's always great to talk to you. We have such great dialogue and always great questions that come in for you as well. You've got a, you certainly have a good fan club here. But yeah, just thank you so much. And everybody that joined us, thanks for being here.
That's it for this one. Join us in our next episode when Forrest Mickey will be here, which if you know Forrest, you know it's going to be good. We'll see you then.